The following is a presentation of TuneRap.com and TuneRapMag.com. TuneRap, the information you crave.
All right, we are here today at the TuneRap Podcast Studios. I guess that's what we're going to call it with Angie Apparel. Let's hear it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know it.
Yeah. It's tough. Angie, going to bring you back a little bit. Some people may know this, some people might not. These days, you've got so many reality shows, Nashville Star, American Idol, and really it's creating a lot of big stars. Talk to us about Star Search and bring us way back, if you can remember.
I remember I was drunk, literally. we had a band that was out playing in like a college circuit thing. And I can't remember who, somebody told somebody about us, and we auditioned for it and did it and lost miserably. But, we were just at that point, I was in a band, I don't know what that was called.
Angie's Hope?
It was probably Angie's Hope. Yeah. We were doing like a college circuit, stuff, and you could sort of in that environment, you could sort of throw originals in. But it was a lot of just classic, like, bullshit rock, kind of, some of it good.
Yeah.
And we kind of tried to opt for playing the stuff we loved, like, we were all, like, into U2 and a bunch of that stuff, and that always went over well. But you could throw in, like, originals and all that, and so we were on that circuit, and it was good money, but somebody heard us in Memphis, I think, and a name went to this, your name gets passed along, and eventually you get on it.
Yeah. So, want to talk to you about your writing. Obviously, you're a huge writer, respected in the industry. Talk to some writers out there, and maybe some new writers out there, about what it's like. How many songs do you think you wrote before you felt like, wow, I'm starting to really get good at this thing?
God. the way I look at writing is that you kind of go through these awakenings, like you have these breakthroughs. Like for me, it was almost like every couple of years. But it's weird. You grow so exponentially that I'm sure every writer looks at this way. You look back like 10 years ago, and I'm like, that was shit. Really just kind of not happy with the things I used to write, but. I get to the point now sometimes where I'm not, I think if you're kind of, I love that All My Words Come Back to Me in Shades of Mediocrity, the Paul Simon lyric. It's just true. I think every writer just kind of, if you're not striving for something more, always, you're kind of dead.
Right.
Artistically, kind of dead. So, although I feel like I've been writing forever. In fact, I had this conversation with, strangely enough, I got to do a writing session with Leanne Rimes yesterday, and we were talking about, you just kind of, that's an odd situation. The co-writing thing is brand new to me, a couple years old. I'd always written, speaking of writing years ago, I hadn't co-written a song ever for 20 years, whatever. And when the thing started with Faith Hill and got me into Nashville, which was a completely foreign environment to me, the co-writing thing started, so the whole notion of that is different to me, and I'm loving it because you learn so much. But I was having this conversation with Leanne, and I said, we were talking about how a writing life kind of can affect your psychology, just the way you live. And I said, we were writing this song kind of about empathy, and I was like, it's really bizarre to me that I wrote my first song when I was 14. I started writing so long ago, and to me, empathy is the most important thing for a songwriter to have, because without it, you'd never hear anything. Because if you relied on poets to have experienced everything before they could write it, they'd have very little to write about.
Sure.
So we were talking about empathy, and I was like, I started at 14, and I literally, that sunk into my psyche so heavy that I have sometimes a hard time differentiating or living my own life. I'm kind of constantly, always vicariously living through moments. And I gave her the example of, it's a cool tool to have as a writer. It's a necessary tool, but it kind of, I don't know if you experience this too, but it kind of creeps into your kind of robs you of somewhat of your of a real experience, because you're always kind of, like I told Leanne, I said I watched my son hug his mother, and it's like, oh, look at the mother and the child. You know, I still know it's my son and my wife or whatever, but it is the most detached, necessary detachment for a writer that wants to travel in his mind everywhere, you know, and be able to write a political song about a region of the country you've never been to, or because you can have empathy for these people. But it is really kind of, it's kind of a weird price.
That really could be a talent, though, that you have to be able to do that.
I agree it is. And that session yesterday was with a writer by the name of Daryl Brown, who's an amazing writer. And he was coming in the room after I was just at the end of that conversation. And he took it even further. He's like, I have moments where I'm seeing something. You know, I think the writer's job is to see things from another angle. But people think I'm detached from the moment. And I'm like, you don't understand. I've gone back and forth in 3 seconds. I've looked at this thing from 100 angles.
Right.
It is sort of what's interesting to me is it's sort of detached and it's sort of the most attached at the same time. It's interesting.
Yeah, but at the same time, does it make you feel like you, as a songwriter, you can also experience things that you've never had to experience? Putting things, you're having to write about things you don't know much about, so you can actually... Do you go there when you write?
Life is, I look at writing as, I really am not really trying to write a song. I'm just trying to say something. And fortunately or unfortunately, the only brush I have is music, kind of. The only tool I have. So it just, for me, for us that, you know, we're born with that inkling, we gravitate towards that to say something. But I just look at writing like there's very little to write about, really. At the end of the day, there's a handful of emotions. There's loneliness, happiness, sadness, love. There's really only 5 or 6. Even if you throw in social, you know, society and politics, there's not many. So what happens to me when I write is I find that I don't like write. I'm never writing a song. There was a great heckle that happened to Neil Young that I heard about, where he's playing a solo show, and I guess it was all acoustic stuff, and he was in the middle of like "Needle in the Damage Done" or some amazing song. He's my idol, by the way. And someone screamed out, "All the songs sound the same." Some, you know, drunk jackass or whatever. And Neil said,
"I think it was me."
Yeah, it was you. Yeah. It was you at the exit end.
Yeah. I said sorry. Jeez.
No, but Neil's response was, it's all the same song, mm-hmm. Like my life. It's just one song. So I kind of, in a slightly different way, when I write, I always find I write in a bizarre way. I have 50 things going at once, just my solo life as a writer. And I just have this whole thing, but I understand that it really is only one thing. And I understand when I look at the 50 things, and there'll be a verse or a chorus or a verse and a chorus, or I used to think that was kind of, it seemed to me at times, I didn't understand why I operated that way, because it seemed to me to be disingenuous. It seemed to almost be like I was a factory. And then I realized, I started looking at the stuff, I just took a moment one day and I was like, what is really in this notebook? I looked at these 50 things and I noticed they broke down into like 4 or 5 categories. So then I was like, well, here's all those songs on loneliness, and there was 10 of them, say. And I was like, really, I'm writing 4 songs, and the song kind of knows what it is, but I'm really not very good at finding it immediately. And I think that's, as writers get better, your editor just finds things immediately, and eventually I won't have to work on 10 songs to get 2. You know what I mean? Like what I would find is, and I went through this exercise where I started writing in categories. And anything, and I just put it in these categories that I had. And I started noticing that I'd have these 3 songs. Wow, those are 3 great songs. And they'd end up being 1. Like, I'd end up being like, really? The way I look at it is, it always knew. The song already knew. And I just wasn't smart enough to figure it out yet. and they were in different keys and sometimes in different tempos, but I would be like, that is really the verse for this song, and that's the chorus, and I'd marry the two. And God, I mean, so many songs, almost half of The American was written that way.
Right.
And I still write that way, but I do find as I get, I hate the word better, because
it's more just experience.
Yeah. Or just, as the craft part of it, which really is just like increasing your toolkit, like I got to buy more wrenches or whatever, as that thing gets bigger, it's less songs for me to get to the point, or less time to get to the point. And I find those categories are kind of not going away, but I can kind of now sit with a tune and be like, and usually, most of the time, I complete it within itself without having to, you know, look through kind of what the hell was I really thinking.
Right.
So, I don't know. It's a roundabout. I don't even remember what the question was. Was it something about a car you were selling?
I can't. Well, we're talking about writing. Let's talk about that a little bit more, but maybe a little more specifically. Here in Nashville, from living here for the last 6 years, I've gotten to know a bunch of writers, and I'm sure it was new to you a few years ago. It's like, okay, 10 in the morning, we sit in this room, we're going to, you know, it's such a different process here. It's a job here. What is it like for you? What's the process specifically? I mean, are you the kind of writer who sees something or sees a movie, or I mean, is it all around you? What do you do specifically, and what can new writers do specifically to work on their craft?
Wow.
Does it hit you at night in your dreams? Is it a morning thing?
I just think it's a life. I just don't... Hemingway said that he only wrote 4 hours a day. He wrote from 8 to noon, I think. And that input was more valuable than output, you know? So it's kind of like, it really is like a writing life. It's not, I think the thing that happens in Nashville, which I've noticed, is that, and it's fine because there's a lot of ways to a great song. But I think whenever things in any form of music, whether it's somebody signs Nirvana and there's 10 Nirvanas, whenever the thing leaves the art life and turns into a kind of a factory, it just, you know, it gets inbred and watered down, and eventually it's shitty, and then everyone's looking for the next new thing. So there's really two questions in that. There's, do you want to live the art life, which is, you might get cuts, you might not, you might have a dry period, you might be the guy, you know, but to drive your, some people can, they'll be very successful, they'll be probably richer than I will be, but I'm just not in for that.
Mm-hmm.
Really just, it's kind of it makes it very difficult to have relationships. It makes it, it's really another life going on that is so intimately, I don't know if you find this, but it is kind of like at the bar, or, you know, I'm writing. I may not be physically, but I'm just, I know what has to happen. Right. And if I do have procedure, it is kind of like that. I've always been listening to like what I'm supposed to do. And I think that intuition of like, it's time to stop. It's time to go get a drink. It's time to walk around the mall. It's time to go to the bookstore. It's time, you know, that's kind of the stuff I'm listening for. I'm not literally looking for a song. I'm looking for a life in it.
Let it come to you.
I think it's, yeah. I think the difference in songwriters that can say things and move people, the ones I respect, is that they understand it's already written. That it's just written somewhere out there, and they're just looking. I'm just looking to be, you know, to be open enough to hear it, or like to know where to go to get it, or to. I was working on this. This is a crazy story about it. I was working on this song. It's almost done. It's called Istanbul, and I'm right in the middle of writing all this political stuff, and not really political, more philosophical, because, you know, war is a product of man, kind of, but. I was in the middle of this thing, and I was like, I had this great melody, and I knew what I wanted, knew what it was, and I was like, and I had this word, you know, and I was like, what a great word to sing. What an interesting, I had read this poem by Billy Collins called Istanbul. And I was like, what an amazing word. And his was just about the beauty of this other culture that he went to experience. And I was like, what if, like, you could write, you could look at that word as like, I'm an idiot when it comes to geography. So I was like, what if people could just all meet up in the middle in Istanbul? Like, we could just make it like, from east to west, I was like, shit, I hope that thing's in the middle of the world. So I was like, I just kind of had this feeling, it was like, it was just time to go to the bookstore. You know what I mean? It was like, well, I need a map. And I swear to God, you know, the world's round, so wherever you look, the middle's different, mm-hmm. depending on what your left and right is. But I just pulled out one of the flat folding guys, a little plastic guy, and literally, it was the first one I pulled out, Istanbul's directly in the middle. So that's kind of the way I look at writing. I look at it as a journey of listening, more than outputting.
Right. Well, we've been talking about it. Why don't you do one?
Holy crap. See if I can remember this one. This is the only country song, real country song I ever wrote.
Anything's country these days.
Yeah. It's called I Got Friends in Low... No. it's called Little Red Brick House. It wasn't too long ago the old man died, and the missus, she soon followed, and they willed everything to the grandkids, but they didn't want anything old or borrowed. So they held an auction the Sunday past and sold it all to strangers. And that little red brick house, cut her down with a ball and chain. She fell to the ground. Gotta make room for lawyers and buildings more sound than that little red brick house. It's 1942, she had a boy in June, and they planted a tree by the old well, and for everyone she carried another seed was buried. Three strong oaks with a tale to tell. And they raised two boys, one beautiful girl, and in my book, buddy, that's good for something. Still that little cut her down with a chainsaw buzzing. The oaks fell to the ground. You gotta make room for lawyers. Buildings more sound than that little red brick house. And I, honey, I stood there that day, saw the wrecking ball come crashing. And I, honey, I watched in vain, saw the wrecking man one beautiful girl, and in my book, buddy, that's good for something. Still that little red brick house, they cut her down with a ball and chain. She fell to the ground. You gotta make room for lawyers and buildings more sound than that little red. Yeah, you gotta make room for lawyers and buildings more sound than that little red brick house.
Whoa. If you don't like that, you don't like music. Come On. Great song.
Thank you.
Well, obviously now people have got to hear you if they hadn't in the past, and they can see what the rage is all about. Let's talk about your career a little bit.
Okay.
Way back in Atlanta, I had a conversation with Rob Thomas from Matchbox 20, and you know, we sort of went up to him and started talking about you, and you could not shut the guy up. I mean, he just, you know, wanted to talk about you, and you know, everybody saw Faith Hill right. on that special, and you know, she said, "I can't believe I'm singing with Angie," you know. And the list goes on and on. You know, John Rich, you know, Big Kenny, these guys are huge fans and big producers, Master Like Dan Huff, you name it. You are so big and well-respected in the industry. Why are you not the biggest thing out there?
You know, it's like, again, those are like, those are just questions for the universe. I mean, they're just not really, just... I can get lost. You can easily get lost in that. Like an artist can easily get lost in it. And I do it frequently. You know, I have enough sense to know it's not important. It is and it isn't. You got to make a living. You got to feed your family. I think the frustration for me comes more from that angle because you're really just trying to buy freedom. Like David Bowie said that the freest he ever became as an artist is when he started paying attention to his business. Which that's a highly, to me, prolific artist, and I know he lives an art life. So to hear that, I, you know, there is a connection, I agree. But I think it's weird. It's like it will rob you. That whole, like, I got songwriter buddies that are always watching the charts, and I'm just like, man, that is a road to nowhere.
Insanity.
It's just, why do you want to chase your tail? It's like every musician I ever met did it for, they got into it for the exact opposite reasons. You know, it's kind of like, it's almost like, what have we become? It's one of those kind of things. So, whereas I know we all got to make a living, and I love every songwriter to make a living because I think writing is important. I think art is important. I think poetry is, I just think it's important. I think the job of the artist is vital in a culture, and wherever you see it removed, you see a lot of fucked up behaviors and psychology. It's the psychology of a culture without art. So I don't know why it's not. But then when I if you think about it, then you're kind of, you really end up almost with almost like a Zen kind of thing. It's like, really, what is the definition of success? Because it's funny that I had this conversation a year or so ago, this kind of, not necessarily just me, but about making it or whatever. And I was like, but isn't it, I can't remember who it was with, but I said, well, isn't it weird though, really, I've never not paid a bill. I've never needed money. But by the world standards, I've been broke. So I'm kind of like, I'm really the richest person ever. If you never want for anything, which is pretty almost biblical, you know, it's kind of like, if you feel taken care of, then you really, what's the difference in having $10 million in the bank and being able to pay all your bills, or having nothing but your bills get paid? So that's just kind of that's a response from, I think artists have to face those things. I think it's also why, because a lot of the world has to face that. There's so many people that don't have, you know, they don't even have what I have. To, you know, they're way worse off than any of us in this room.
Sure.
So I think for an artist that has to kind of, I think it's important, that question is important because it the answers to it are, can be bigger and maybe helpful to people because they end up that we write about them. We write about those answers, mm-hmm. about why things are, you
right.
know.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. It's weird just from the business standpoint. It is, to me, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's in a weird way. It's kind of as rewarding to just to have, you know, just to have some kind of alliance with other people I respect.
Right.
Well, you know what I mean?
It's got to make you feel good when, I mean, you can't go anywhere and people are just raving about you. I mean,
it's a good feeling.
And we're not just talking about college kids, although obviously, you know, what college kids say matters too, but we're talking about major people in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, it feels good. But it feels good more, really, just... I lead a real solitary life. I mean, just... Even most of the time when the band's on tour, I travel alone. I have to just write constantly. So for me, it is rewarding. But the bigger thing for me is that I have a community. Like I have friends that, I mean, I've just kind of been a friendless, not because I don't like people. I'm just busy. I mean, I'm just really, and it's rough. It's rough on a wife. It's rough on children. It's rough on, but to remove it is like, well, then it's not me. Right. You know, so.
Back a few years ago, I noticed that you started taking things into your own hands a little bit. Can you talk about that and talk about the direction that you have gone in the last few years and what you're doing in the future as far as the internet, sites like TuneRat, things like that?
Right, right. Well, the internet obviously is, you know, it's the new kind of, well, it's literally new media, but after the Arista, I was on Arista Records for a couple years, and around 2002, I mean, the internet it's exponentially, what it's capable of is in 5 years is insane how it's grown. But yeah, I just kind of became heavily invested, because I always was before I got signed. When I, in 95, I went solo and I left any band I was in, whatever it was, and made my first independent record in Nashville, which is bizarre, at House of David, I think a studio here. And David Briggs played on it, and I don't know how that ever happened, because I'm a huge David Briggs fan. And then I had that indie thing in me for, like, I didn't get signed until 98 or something. So for 3 years, I was just kind of out. And that was a weird thing, too. It's kind of my introduction to being an independent artist, because I just kind of, it was very interesting. And this kind of leads to that your last question. I made this record. I was so over music. And I was like, I just want to like it again. You know, I'm just so tired of it being like, oh, we booked. Oh, yeah, God. It becomes everything you never wanted it to become. So I made this record called Out of the Everywhere. And it's a folky kind of acoustic, real kind of intimate, abstract thing. And I just made it. And I was like, I am making a record. And I wouldn't make plans beyond it. Like, I'd be like, okay, I need 10, 11 songs. So I'd write 10, 11 songs. And I'd be like, okay, I need players. So I'd find players. I never got to I'm going to press it. I was like, okay, it's done. Now I need to master it. Okay, that's done. Okay, I'll press it. But each step was slow, and because I didn't want to get caught up into, and I'll get 1,000 copies, and then I'll get them out to all the agents, and I didn't want to get caught. That's what I was getting away from. So it's so weird. I pressed 1,000 of them. They come to my living room. I was living on the north end of Atlanta, and I was like, okay, there's 1,000, you know. But I still wouldn't. I had an agent, a good agent in New York, and I was like, can you just get me some shows? You know, yep. And I did the whole just. Everything you've ever heard before, which you have to do. And I had a great conversation with Steve Forbitt about this, about just what an artist should do. And I just, no plans. My only plan was, what's my schedule this month, even this week? You got the show at the Bitter End, and you got the da-da-da-da, you got these six things in the Northeast, then you're going to go. And I just got in my Honda Accord and put 200,000 miles on it and didn't. Literally, here's the funny thing about intention. I didn't never sent the record to anyone, and it's the thing that got me signed. Never did anything but just play, you know, shows, and had a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Not really, you know, a good review in New York, a couple of whatever. And then the record somehow got in Matt Serletic's hands, and da 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 da. Then Arista, and then because of that independent experience. When Arista was done, I was like, you know what, I can do that again. And by the way, I need to learn how to like this again, because I was starting to really hate it.
Right.
It was just, I mean, I loved making the American and all that, and it was a wonderful experience. But man, the machine is brutal. It's, you know, that's why I think artists just have to go away at times.
Right.
So I've kind of invested heavily in the internet, mostly on our site, because it's kind of your connection to your fans, you know. So we're doing that, and then this Tune Rad thing is obviously extremely exciting because the potential of that community. And what's weird I've found about the internet is that you... I had a conversation with an industry guy, to remain nameless, but a very powerful, influential guy, and just knows a lot. It was a fascinating conversation. We were talking about, on the business side of things, which I find interesting. Well, I just find it very interesting as far as culturally, when I'm looking at a society, like a capitalist society or just America in particular, I just find it fascinating why something can sell 15 million records. Even if I was just a poet, wasn't even in music, it just fascinates me. It's like, what's driving that? Mm-hmm. And I asked this fellow that, and he was like, you know, it's kind of, really, it's all about a culture around music that, you know, music alone without having something surrounding it that is, I wear those jeans and that hat, and I like that beer, and I like, without that kind of around something to create this society.
You gotta create a thing.
You have to create a society of people. The 10 million that buy the record. It's like really something music really can't do that on its own. And what I find powerful about that is that it's really an accolade to music because it means that when it's great, it can create a community. It can create a whole mini society. So the internet, to dovetail into that, what I find fascinating about it is to an independent artist, it does allow us to grow these microcultures like in a very small way, what a label with a lot of money can do in a major way. The internet allows the independent artists to like find these, to build a little community. It's very bizarre. And it's very bizarre to know that you can put something out on the web and not even offer it for download, just offer it for spins or whatever so they can listen to it. And a month later, people are requesting it in every club you go to. Mm-hmm. That's like crazy. Like 10 years ago, impossible. Mm-hmm. Impossible to go to a town 5 hours away from you and have 100 people in a room knowing the words to your song, and it's never been released. And you haven't been to the town, ever played it. And there's no label. The power of that is, I find it fascinating. So we're heavily invested in the internet.
And do you think... you know, what's the future of the music industry in the next 5 years? Where do you see it? Just
God, if I had that answer, we'd be...
Well, of course, but I mean, yeah. Do you think the internet is the place to be, sort of thing? It doesn't seem like it's going anywhere. It seems like it's just gaining momentum.
I don't think it's going anywhere. I mean, obviously. I think what's going to happen, though, is... And as far as how the music industry can respond to it, who knows? My God, you know, there's people trying to crack that as we speak.
Sure. As are we.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't, again, to someone living an art life, it doesn't really matter to me.
Yeah.
It does, and it doesn't.
Do your thing and where you fit in, we'll see.
You know what? God has, there's things above me that, you know, you just kind of have to live in your time, I think, and everyone lives in their time. You know what? When the printing press came out, which basically is the internet to me, it's kind of like, people were freaking out. It was like, oh my God. You know, and there was all the negative side of it too. It's like, what do you mean? We can't just hear the story from the old man sitting on the tree stump. You know what I mean? Whatever. Because it was going to destroy folklore because that's the only way stories were getting passed down. But now it was just like, you know, 1,000 books could be printed or whatever. And the internet's kind of that way to me. But to an artist, I just think you just kind of, dude, I'm living in every time. I'm living an eternal life, so it might as well be the 1500s for me. I don't really, you know what I'm saying? Because the nature of things to write about will never change. The nature of man will never change. Right. There was, you know. But I do think, yeah, the internet is an amazing tool. I think an artist can get lost in it, though, and think it's the answer.
Yeah, but as an artist, don't you feel like that you have, you know, what you want to do is you want to write songs, you want to get your songs out to people, you want them to hear what you're doing, the situation kind of facilitates a need, since you can't like grassroots thing on corporate radio anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I think it's wonderful. It's you know what there's two things. You know, it's like kind of like you're everyone is always living on both sides of their brain. So on that side of my brain, as far as the logistics and the business of it, it's amazing. to be able to spread the word and get people to the show and da 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 da. But it is, to me, it's one of those things where it always just is what it is. It wasn't less amazing when I hear this argument all the time. Well, now the artist is free and he can release his own stuff. And I mean, because honestly, it was a bit before my time, before I was ready to make it. But I never had the opportunity to, when they were making records like pressing wax, which I still want to do because I just find it a fascinating medium. But yeah, I don't know that it's. I hear that argument like it's so free for the artist, this and that. And I'm like, you know what? At the end of the day, it sort of is and sort of isn't. It, whatever it has gained the artist, it has taken this massive amount of people that can really clutter up something really fucking quickly. And for as easy as it is to get it out there, it's just as hard to make it stick or to get it to make people really think, because people are becoming so just bombarded with media. So whatever it has brought to the situation, there's probably a bit that it's stolen.
Sure.
Probably. I mean, MTV was great, but I think it robbed the imagination from the listener. I think it dumbed down the listener. I think it did.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact to put images, to attach images to songs, it's great, but I don't know. Go see a musical. You know, it's cool, but it really does. It has created kind of a less engaged theater of the mind for the listener.
Changes the focus.
So I think the internet's, it's good and bad, I think. But again, the other side of my brain doesn't give a shit.
Right. It's there. You got to use it.
It's there. It's cool. Use it. Yeah.
Anything else, Steve? Angie, anything you want to...
I got to pet the dog.
You want to...
The dog's going crazy. The thunder's killing him.
We've got thunder and lightning here in Nashville. And, I think we're going to wrap it up before we blow up some equipment. So thank you, Angie,
and thank you,
good luck. And everybody can look for Angie on TuneRat.
Cool. Yeah, give your information, your website and all that stuff.
AngieApparo.com. Simple.
All right. Pretty
cool. All right.
Excellent job. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been a presentation of TuneRat.com and TuneRatMag.com. To download this podcast and other podcasts, log on to TuneRat.com. TuneRat, the information you crave.